Good evening. This is Jim Breerling. Welcome to our special August 4th call-in with Congressman Patrick Kennedy. And joining him this evening as well is Ken Duckworth, a MD psychiatrist, the medical director of NAMI, and which is a part-time job, so he complements it with something that will relate to his NAMI work. And right now he is looking at health insurance claims to Blue Cross Blue Shield for Romney Care in the state, which will be fascinating to see, and is certainly highly relevant to parity and cost issues and so forth. What a resource. And I also have to say we were just deluged with questions and concerns, as I was telling Congressman Kennedy. So we have some people online here to join in after his talk and after Dr. Duckworth's remarks to get elaboration and interaction. They will have to leave at 9 or soon after, but we will keep the phone line open for those who would like to have a more general discussion to pursue, given the hot interest in this. Turning to, I want to say something about NAMI for people. If you don't know about NAMI, the National Alliance on the Mentally Ill, it's an organization to join for advocacy, for its work on parity, its grading the states for their mental health services and other things. And NAMI has just been phenomenal in adding, supportive of borderline, adding it to disorders of focus, has included consistently a nice range of borderline relevant presentations at the NAMI annual conference, has an online chat room for borderlines, and has been active and willing to co-sponsor meetings with the NEA BPD, including conferences and congressional briefings. And Dr. Duckworth has been an NI representative and a contributor at these gatherings of information, perspective, and wisdom. So we're really delighted to have him, and he has kind of graciously consented to come back and talk further with us for a longer session. For Patrick Kennedy, I think most of you may know that he's the youngest son of Ted Kennedy. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 16 years until 2011, and given what's happened since then, it probably was an act of sanity to choose not to stand for re-election. He is the author and lead sponsor of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Recovery Act of 2008. So he's really on top of this. He is co-founder of the One Mind for Research that has excited so many people in the borderline community, because we know how vital research has been for changing the conception and offering hope instead of a despair and despondency, but we still have a way to go. He also has been recognized as for fundraising and advocacy as chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee back in 1999 to 2001, and he's won an array of awards for health care advocacy. His talk has stirred up considerable interest. I was telling him before we started, wound up with 4 pages, single-space type pages of questions about parity, which we've tried to boil down to a couple of questions that, given the time constraints. And, you know, the whole insurance issue is so big for us because people have spent hundreds of thousands, and in one case, Helen Sneed's case, even $1 million on treatment before finally getting to evidence-based and innovative family-funded treatment that really made a difference and enabled her to recover largely and resume an activity in normal life. And she will share that with us later. Mentioned about the research and how we have gone from hopelessness and despair to a good news diagnosis, and although we have a way to go. And again, we have very active engagement that I wanted to note for everybody, phenomenal engagement. In 2000, the Borderline Personality Disorder Research Foundation came along with, at its head, a family member with a that had a borderline loved one, And with its over $30 million worth of funding, really energized the field. And very shrewdly, the head of that foundation got three Nobel laureates to serve on his board of directors and also engaged the then director of NIMH, Steve Hyman, on the board. And that's how NIMH got out of a slumber about borderline and actively engaged, so that now current director regularly has blog mentions and refers to borderline with the other disorders and is starting to get the attention it deserves. But we have this enormous parent activism that I think people are showing up in the comments, that people want to engage on addressing parity and research and stigma, because it's transferred through the NEA, BBD, to get the research and information out to family members and consumers. And also not just to leave things to wait for researchers. There's people, parents, developing a peer-to-peer curriculum. And, of course, I mentioned the stigma and what a big, big issue is that. So we've got a lot to engage with, and we're so gracious for Congressman Kennedy joining us this evening. Let me turn it over to him. I hope everybody's got their slides. He's asked to go through the whole presentation, and then we'll come back for questions and discussions, starting with Dr. Duckworth. Congressman Kennedy, it's yours.
Well, thank you, Jim, and I appreciate everybody being on and your advocacy. And I do have a slide presentation. As we talked, I think I'll just make a quick overview of the main themes that I think are what we need to focus on as advocates, and then of course be available for questions. Let me just begin by saying that I have an intense urgency about treating mental health the same as overall health, and I believe that while we in this call will go through the specifics of the legislation called parity, and while we could talk endlessly about how insurance companies are going to manage parity, and then what the effect will be, and most importantly on all of us and our loved ones, I really want to focus my brief comments on what I see as the single biggest issue confronting all of us, and that is political advocacy. I absolutely believe that none of the issues that we will undoubtedly raise about, you know, adequate funding, adequate attention, adequate coverage, treatment, and the like, will ever be realized if we're not first and foremost politically engaged. And I think that, of course, stigma has been our biggest opponent, because it keeps people isolated and it keeps them from speaking up. And when they do speak up, they often feel shamed because of the way stigma is so pervasive in our society. Insurance companies count on that, and that's one of the reasons why they have been unrelenting in their very burdensome and discriminatory practices when it comes to coverage for a physical health issue that happens to be a mental health issue. So, and in terms of Congress and governments, both at the state level and local and federal, it's all a matter of whether there is, a vote, and whether there are the sufficient funds that other kind of lobbying organizations have and bring to the political process. That means that we're always going to be challenged in terms of being able to effectively get what we need if we're not better organized politically. So, all of that said, I do think very optimistically that we have an incredible opportunity to see this vision that we've all had, where the brain is treated like every other organ in the body. I think that we're going to have this opportunity come the next year or so as it plays itself out with health care reform and with the final rule on the mental health parity bill. And I also think that we're also going to see an acceleration of brain research, funded research. And for one reason, for both of these things, I think it's the returning, the experience of our returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan, and the unique set of challenges that have been portrayed to the general public of these quote-unquote invisible wounds of war. This is what I think is going to be the catalyst for the kind of political response that I think we've all been waiting far too long on from government, from the federal, state, and local level. And now I have to tell you I'm quite shocked that we haven't mounted a bigger effort to meet the needs of our returning veterans in this regard. But I do believe that ultimately our strongest kind of political platform will be to take up their cause, because their cause is frankly our cause. And you know, the denials that we get in our community for insurance coverage, you know, they're going to get, and they're going to get it in the same way that we do. They're a new member of our community that's being discriminated against. And most particularly, I believe that these veterans, you know, they're going to run up against the same treatment limitations and discriminatory insurance practices that we've run up against in our experiences. But I believe that there is going to be an opportunity for us to galvanize much broader public attention from the general public as well as the corporate world to take this on. And I believe that with your support, we can do that and carry our message forward. The other point I would have to make is that equality is our platform. And what I mean by that is we want to be on the side of just asking for the same urgency of effort with respect to physical health care coverage as every other disease. We don't want anything more than cancer gets or diabetes gets or heart disease. We want just the same. We don't want any more. And I think politically, as a community, we often get isolated and siloed and become very irrelevant because we're so focused on trying to just get mental health services. But what we're really asking for is the same treatment in terms of medical care that you would get if you had diabetes, cancer, any other physical health issue that gets treated with this, with what we would all imagine to be, you know, medical care. And I think, frankly, that for understandable reasons, our community is can never kind of see, if you will, the forest from the trees, and because the needs are so great and the pent-up demand is so great that when we ask for things, we're asking in a way that allows us to be dismissed as a special interest. And I think that in this austerity environment, that the best way for us to get what really would be a windfall for the field of mental health and treatment will be to simply you know, demand that we get the same as other physical health care. It may seem like I'm telling you something that's just about semantics, but in my 16-plus years in Congress and in my lifetime studying political science, I can tell you that it really matters how you approach this thing. No one wants to be seen as discriminatory, and we need to really be clear that we're not asking for something from anybody that they wouldn't be obligated to give us simply by the rule of equal justice. So I think I'll stop there. And then I'll be happy to talk in greater depth about, you know, the parity law. I'd also be happy to talk about One Mind for Research, and also what we're going to try to do to really promote both of those causes of research and equal treatment through the recognition of my uncle's 50th anniversary of his signing both the Maternal and Child Health Act and the Community Mental Health Facilities Act of 1963, which I think will give us an opportunity to kind of look back at the last 50 years, see some of the successes and failures of the community mental health movement, and really take this opportunity of healthcare reform as the opportunity to fulfill the vision that President Kennedy articulated 50 years ago this October. So with that, again, I thank everybody for participating on the call, and I appreciate the opportunity to share this common mission with all of you.
Well, what a wonderful call to vision and action. Dr. Duckworth, would you have anything to add now?
Yeah, I'd just like to, I think I speak for all of us when I'd just like to say thank you to the Congressman for all your leadership on this important issue. And from my experience, the National Alliance on Mental Illness has really taken borderline personality disorder on as a core area of interest, which is a change I advocated for and continue to welcome. It's important for several reasons. One is the public health burden of borderline personality disorder is substantial. And it's also helped me as the medical director of this enormous organization to be able to talk about psychological trauma in a way, given the field's history of blaming families for bad outcomes, which is an unfortunate fact of my forebears in psychiatry. It's been really important to be able to talk about the role of trauma, how it impacts people, how people can work with it and overcome it. And my take on parity is, you know, I think probably a slightly unusual one, and that I testified for mental health parity both in Massachusetts and with Congressman Kennedy's father and Paul Wellstone back in the day. You know, Massachusetts has a pretty good parity law that precedes the federal parity law, and borderline personality disorder is in that law. What I like about the parity law in the time that I worked for Blue Cross is the idea of parity is a fundamental one and easy to translate. So if one policy applies in one place, we want to have it apply in another place. A change that some people may not know about, but as a variation on parity, is how doctors are paid and therapists are paid completely changed on January 1st from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in a way that really supports parity if the insurance companies go with it. So Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts pays for all the E&M codes, and E&M codes are how primary care doctors are paid. They're called evaluation and management codes. And the idea is that psychiatrists are now counseling patients about their medical care and their psychiatric vulnerabilities. They have to do more documentation, but this documentation is very similar to what a primary care doctor does. And notably, the psychiatrist is paid the identical amount as the primary care doctor. So what's interesting about this is that this is a game changer in terms of how psychiatrists see themselves in terms of increasing their medical role. That is to say, you have to take people's blood pressure. You have to weigh them if they're on antipsychotic medicines. So the return of the doctor role is, I think, another outgrowth of the parity movement. So I just wanted to mention that because I bet how doctors are paid doesn't come up a lot in your call, but I think it's quite relevant to the parity conversation. And not all insurance companies pay for all E&M codes, but I think it's important to recognize that the ones that do are essentially funding the time for the doctors in an identical structure and payment, which I view as a win in the parity world. So I'll stop there, and maybe I can jump in later as needed.
Well, please do. Parity folks, would you like to follow up on this? Pat Porter?
Absolutely. First of all, Congressman Kennedy, I was one of the people at Atlantic City when we met just before your son was born. And we came down really expecting someone with, with political savvy and conviction. But what really surprised us, and we remarked on it after the meeting, is how well you seem to understand what's going on the ground, what it's like for ordinary people trying to deal with mental illness. And we were very impressed, and we're very grateful to have you on our side. So as we had, as Jim mentioned, five typed pages of questions, and as we looked at them, they really kind of broke down into questions about how parity would be enforced, questions about how medical equivalency would be defined, and really kind of how are people going to find out, what parity means and what to do if they're not getting the treatment that they are entitled to. And I just wondered, what you see as the biggest challenge there, and if you could comment on those different categories just briefly.
Sure. Well, just to go back to my original point, I totally think political power solves all the problems, and I don't want to be cavalier about this. But if we're in the business of trying to compute parity based upon, what an insurance company is going to decide to do on which codes, on which inpatient versus outpatient, in-network, out-of-network, whether it's going to be on a prescription formulary or an ER visit, there is just going to be a million and one ways that insurance companies are going to find ways to discriminate. And that's just my experience. And so, it's a game of whack-a-mole. Once you try to cover and say, oh, this is prohibited to discriminate against, they're going to find another way to discriminate. And so my focus for the whole mental health community is keeping our eyes on the prize, and that is to have effective advocacy and effective messaging so that we don't get lost thinking that we're winning these battles when we lose the war. And what I mean by that is, I think we need a whole societal change on mental health, and I think we're going to have all of the things that we want if there's a change. And I honestly believe that our returning heroes from Iraq and Afghanistan are the catalyst, because 72% of them will never go to a VA in their lifetime, and all of them are going to have quote-unquote invisible wounds of war. And all of them are going to have coverage to some extent or another in the rest of the healthcare system through its hodgepodge healthcare system, their employer-based or some other type of coverage. And the bottom line is they're going to run up against the same challenges that we run up against all the time. And I think that, and I know for a fact this is not going to go away. So I absolutely believe we need to, have this message that, we demand nothing more than equal coverage and treatment. And I worry that we get lost in so many of these are big battles. Don't get me wrong, but the way I hear administration officials talk about this, and even in the mental health community, worries me, because we are so willing to accept substandard care because it's more than we've gotten in the past. And I was the champion of parity, so I know the many ways that people pushed back, and I also know many of our roadblocks, and a lot of them came from our own community. And this experience will stay with me forever, and that is that, you know, there wasn't just universal belief that we ought to get full parity. And a lot of, including NAMI, was against a full parity bill when I was in Congress, because they wanted to accept a much narrower definition of parity because they wanted success on something. And at the time, it was a political decision upon NAMI to say that we should take what we can get. And honestly, I don't begrudge them that because, you know, those of us in the mental health world just get so little, we'll take whatever we can get. So my point is, this is a new day and we're all on to a new chapter, but I think that the mental health community unfortunately gets so lost because you've got psychiatrists fighting for this, you've got psychologists fighting for that, social workers, and you've got this system and that system, and we're losing the battle, the war, I should say, because we're fighting all these battles. So I don't mean to not get into the specifics, but I hope that it addresses the point I'm trying to make, and that is that we need to get a much bigger message so that we can take this to everybody. So it's not, you know, the borderline personality disorder. It's not the bipolar disorder. It's not the schizophrenia disorder. It's not, you know, the depressive disorder. It's, you know, it's health care, and we demand the brain be treated the same. And I think that's going to be our winning message, and especially if, you know, we take up this cause, of the many challenges that our returning vets are facing, because their wounds are going to reflect themselves in many of the symptomologies that all of us have dealt with through our challenging diagnoses.
Well, I think from the veterans' point of view, there's been some write-ups in the press and so forth about stigma actually within the military against a BPD diagnosis. So that's going to be,
yes,
a particular challenge. Building on what you said about, you know, this is a war that's going to have to be fought battle by battle. And for most people who have mental illness, fighting with the insurance companies over a decision is beyond them. I mean, it's beyond their energy level, beyond, you know, they may not have a sense of entitlement, they may not have the support to file all the paperwork. What support network do you see? What would you recommend to help people pursue their rights, the individual consumer?
So, again, on the big picture, you know, everybody knows that someone who has a mental illness, which is effectively treated, that it not only saves the person and makes their lives better, but it saves the whole healthcare system money. Because if anybody is like me, when my mental illness wasn't properly treated, I ran up all kinds of other costs in our healthcare system. And the actuarial studies all reflect this, you know, Milman and all of them. So what I'd like us to do is focus on how do we get the for-profit, if you will, the capitalist system that still seems to be in place with these insurance companies that are looking at the bottom line, and have them look at mental health as a value added, rather than as something that's going to be a cost factor. And frankly, I think that, you know, we need to, as a community, discuss whether we're going to, what our policies are going to be on carve-outs. Because I think you're going to save a lot more lives if the insurance companies do not look at this as them trying to do the right thing by those with mental illness, but rather them trying to do the right thing by their bottom line. And as you know, therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, they are over, managed by insurance companies. Their frequency and duration is like so limited, and yet it's clearly by every standard of modern science definitively evidence-based medicine. But it's impossible for us to fight all individually when they're pursuing policies that, on the face of them, these policies are so patently discriminatory and violating everything in modern science that we know. So my view would be, how do we have an audit capability of these insurance practices so that we're certain that we're not being, segregated, in that we're being treated and we're included with all medical care. And I think that will help us address a lot of these systemic issues of individual discrimination, because if you have a carve-out of some of these behavioral management companies, all they're trying to do is limit costs, but they're looking at costs in a very narrow way. They're only looking at mental health costs. They're not seeing the benefit to your overall health when you have your mental health treated effectively. That's just someone else's bucket. And the problem is, if they keep those two buckets separate, we're never going to win, because they'll always look at the mental health community as a cost as opposed to, a value when, looked upon in the whole sense of the term of the person and of the value of health care.
Well, so, and there's a broader context in terms of employment and welfare costs and so forth, too.
No question about it. And you're absolutely right. Ideally, those are going to start to be captured in the new world that we're going into, where we're talking about these global budgets. But some of the challenges we face in the mental health community is many in the mental health community are insisting on higher privacy standards, and granted, I understand with stigma, but if we're not in the same healthcare record as everyone else, we'll always be the stepchildren, if you will, in the healthcare system. We'll always be on the outside looking in. And these persistent kind of two-tiered healthcare systems where you pay docs in the regular healthcare this, and as you heard from Ken, you often pay the docs in mental health differently. All that's been made possible because we've had this two-tiered approach to healthcare.
So what can we do as advocates, as family members, individual medical practitioners? What can we do?
So I think we need to really synthesize what is parity. We need to do it for the broader American community and the broader American family in a way that makes them think, oh, of course, and so that is why I think that these transparency requirements, public disclosure requirements upon insurance companies to disclose, how they organize and manage their benefits is so crucial. Because like I said, we could micromanage the little, benefit here, the little benefit there, but if their pattern and, quote, pattern and practice of managing mental health on its face is built upon a faulty premise, then everything that comes from it is going to be discriminatory. So I think we, and of course insurance companies do not want anyone to look at their books. They don't want anyone to know how they make their decisions. But I think that's obviously where our whole battle is. Because they might think that they're taking care of us by giving us, an EM code, or they might think they're taking care of us by doing something here. But at the end of the day, if they're
not structured in a way that ensures equal treatment, we're always going to be fighting this fight in an uphill battle. So I have been pressing the administration to really require insurance companies to have very strong public disclosure requirements. And I'm not saying that they ought to have voluntary requirements. I think we need to mandate that they disclose all the pieces of information that are going to be crucial, because the good thing with parity is if we identify a pattern and practice of discriminatory behavior on their part, then we can take this to court. But if we don't even know how they're practicing insidious discrimination in a multitude of ways, because we're all kept in the dark on how they operate, and I appreciate how, Ken, you are interested in kind of getting to the bottom of that. I am absolutely with you. I think that's where the whole action is really getting that public disclosure and the transparency, because that's it. That is where we're going to be able to fight this fight, so that you and your family member are not going to be isolated. You know, whether it's in Rhode Island and you've been discriminated here, or Connecticut here, or Texas here, or Indiana here, we're going to have an ability, and NAMI, I'm sure, is going to take a major part in this, in showing how, you know, you're not alone in this world, and you're not going to have to fight this alone anymore.
So what's the role of the state insurance commissioner in all of this?
Well, like everything in politics, they're going to have their hearings, and they're all going to have pressure on them. And most of the pressure and the money is going to come from the hospitals, because they have the most money and the most political, you know, power. And so, you know, we really need to go into this with our eyes wide open. And I know we've been, you know, knocked down so many times, it's hard for us not to know what we're up against. But my major feeling is that, you know, we can't go in there with this feeling that it's all on the level. Okay? You know, we've got this great law. It's terrific. It's federal law. And, yes, the Obama administration made it as part of the essential health benefits. But, you know, everything is political, and at the end of the day, it all follows, like, you know, track the money. Where's the money? Where is it? Because that's where you're going to find the political power. And right now, we've never been funded, so we don't have that money to, in the system to fight for our interests. And so, my feeling is, you know, the very least we need to show up, bottom line is you're going to have all the professional societies. Ken knows, you know, all of his counterparts in oncology and cardiology and all of these other specialties and, you know, the hospitalists all show up, and they're going to demand, you know, that they're going to need X, Y, and Z. And you know what? For most of the part, they're going to get it. And so we need to have, you know, something that equalizes this playing field. And that's why I believe that if we make everyone in this country understand that there's a basic fight for justice here, and that our American heroes, our veterans, have invisible health care, because their invisible wounds are not addressed in the same way as their visible wounds, I think we can turn all of this into a much stronger argument for the whole array of services, whether those services are for borderline personality disorder or someone with a bipolar disorder or someone with schizophrenia or someone with, you know. My point is that we need to unite here to be more effective. And that would be my, that's where I believe we ought to be.
Can I inject, because I've had some interaction with the VA about this. The major disorder that I understand that would be a concern here from the vets returning is PT, but not the only one, but the major one is most frequent would be PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the concern that I hear from them is the absence of a biomarker, that we're really having to rely upon the self-report, which can be distorted.
Right. So that's what brings me back to my original point, that we need to be part of the whole healthcare system, because whether you're, this is a quote-unquote subjective thing, which we all know it's not, or ultimately we'll have biomarkers, the smart healthcare system and insurance system is going to see, you know, either we treat this and we meet this person's needs, or they're going to cost us in a whole lot of other ways, so that it becomes less of us having to, you know, fight in the block and tackle on the specific issue as much as the realization that you can't divorce the brain from the rest of the body, that, you know, mental health is whole health. And I think that that's going to be the ground that we have that's going to make the most sense for us.
This is Ken. I wanted to ask a little bit about how the NIMH budget is doing from your perspective, Congressman, because the quest for biomarkers has been elusive given the complexity of the brain. It's something we all want, look forward to. Progress is being made all the time. I find us follow the science pretty closely. I know Dr. Insel was worried about the NIMH budget with sequestration, but the research questions, you know, on things like biomarkers, you know, remain a central quest for us to get on a parity footing ultimately biologically, which I think has been one of our Achilles heels because of the complexity of the brain. So funding for NIMH then becomes one of the linchpins of getting this straight. What's your experience of that right now?
So my experience is that we've got over a dozen separate institutes studying the brain. And even though Tom has been terrific trying to get that, you know, blueprint and trying to get everyone to work together, the bottom line is we're still behind the times in the way we organize our clinical research, so that when Nora Volkow and NIDA or Story Lannis and NINDS or Tom at NIMH or, you know, any NICHD, if we ever were able to better organize ourselves, we're talking about the most complex organ in the body, as you point out. The bottom line is we're still, you know, doing these clinical trials based upon an old way of thinking in terms of how to organize this. We're really not, and I can only tell you that my position on this has been kind of endorsed by a lot of modern forward-thinking neuroscientists who all acknowledge that, you know, we're going to get to our common understanding of the brain together, as opposed to every single diagnosis fighting for their own little clinical trial, thinking that they're going to own magic little bullet, and that we're going to find these answers by going through every back road out there, as opposed to us all getting on the same bus and driving down this big highway that's called understanding the brain and finding our respective exits, because we're going to find that bipolar borderline personality disorder exit is right next to the, you know, bipolar exit, which is near the exit for schizophrenia, and they're going to find that, you know, there's going to be an off-ramp for this one and that one. And the bottom line is we've been so bunched up, you know, thinking in a really small way that we're missing the real patterns that are going to give us the answers. And so I would say my feeling is, you know, we need to do this and understand how the brain works. And I think, again, veterans are going to be the national security call that gets us to spend this money. Because, you know, many of my colleagues on the other side of the political spectrum don't want to spend anything on anything called research. They just don't, you know, see a return. They don't, you know, they can be, it's just that's the nature of the politics. I think we can get a much bigger political support for something for veterans, for
the traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress, but understand this. I'm not talking about TBI and PTS, because if you study TBI, you've got Alzheimer's under there, you've got Parkinson's under there, you've got ALS under there, you've got all of that, and you look under PTS, you've got all of our affective disorders are under PTS in terms of the mechanisms of the brain. So I'm talking about the politics here of neuroscience in a way that gets greater federal commitment to do more research that's going to yield greater results for all of us and our family members. So, I think the way we fight for this is going to determine whether we're going to be successful on it or not.
Okay. I have a lot of questions popping up, but for time, there's stigma is a big thing. Carolyn, are you with us? Ash, are you with us? Hello? Well, let me...
Again?
Go ahead.
Hello, this is Ash.
Ash, would you like to raise your stigma question with Congressman Kennedy?
Sure, I'd love to. My question is kind of two-parted. So we talked a bit about how we can fight for reform and advocacy as a united front, but when it comes to the stigma, especially from consumers advocating for their own mental health parity, how can they be seen beyond the eyes of stigma by policymakers? How can they be most effective in communicating with the policymakers?
As I said, I mean, I think that I know that within the mental health community, you feel a stigma, you know, especially so. And I think that you could tell from my earlier comment about the fight for the parity bill overall that, you know, many wanted to keep the original bill, you know, very, you know, tight, if you will, to, you know, the, quote, biologically based disorders, you know, as they were, you know, back in the day. So, you know, there's been, you know, enormous resistance even within the mental health community to really embrace all of us as having an equal part in trying to overcome stigma. And the insurance companies know this, and they prey upon that so that they pit everyone against each other, and, of course, they reimburse more for some than they do others. And it's really insidious. So we have to come back, as we did with the parity, the notion of the principle of parity, and that's equality. We're all in it together. We have different symptomology, but we're all united with the same stigma that we all face, having an illness that not only needs to have healing, but also which demands kind of people being embraced, and of course, if society isolates us and marginalizes us, when what we really need is to have that, community and sense of connectedness. So, you know, I think that there's a way of defining this that's much bigger than the individual disorder, and I think that that's been my goal, kind of as a political person, is how do we find the common ground that unites us all, even though some of us have illnesses that are more stigmatized than others. We really need to see the common elements that we all share so we can fashion this in a way that can garner much broader public acceptance for the base issue, which is, are we going to be treated equally? And if an Alzheimer's family sees that as their definition, it's the same one that someone from a family of the borderline personality disorder and someone with a veteran family who has a PTSD, or someone with a family you know, that's where we need to come out, is to kind of define this metric the same, so that we have strength in numbers and also a vision of this being something much bigger than, you know, you're not acknowledging me. This is about equal treatment, and everybody's going to be marching to the same kind of tune. That's my hope, is that what we can do is develop that strategy.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Carolyn, I'll read her question here. I am the mother of a child with borderline personality disorder. What are two or even three things I can do besides giving money to get active and support increased awareness, ending of stigma, getting funded for local or federal projects? I think it really is, what's this army of for winning the war going to look like?
Well, as I said, I think that, you know, in each of these states with the exchanges and with insurance companies in general, you know, we need to have both tell our stories. I mean, that's going to be ultimately the most effective thing. But we need to, in my slide presentation, I give a couple of websites that, you know, of groups that are trying to collect, including www.parityispersonal.org. You know, we need to make sure that we all know that we're not alone out there. And so if there are stories of this discrimination, which all of your families have dealt with over and over again, you know, I know that you're all together now through this alliance, but my point is that, you know, we obviously need to raise the visibility of this, you know, much more. And when someone gets in trouble with insurance discrimination, it should be the cause for everyone else. And trying to come up with those stories so that, you know, you're not feeling like you're just so isolated. So I would encourage, you know, as you already are as part of this alliance, and when you face issues of loved one not getting the treatment that they would otherwise get if they had leukemia, you know, we need to be there to support you, and that story needs to be out there so that others will gain, you know, courage and also strength from your fight. And I totally believe that everyone who's fighting this fight is making it easier for the next person down the line to wage that same battle against stigma.
Anyone have any other questions on stigma from a group that's on live? The question I have here was, several people wanted to know on the Kennedy Forum coming up October 23rd and subsequent activities, how they might be involved and how they might help with this effort.
Well, what we're trying to do, and I'm like everyone else, just trying to do the best I can with, you know, what I have as a former member of Congress, trying to stay active, involved in this, is to try to keep the attention on the subject, because, you know, there, I think that it's very easy for, with all the other issues in terms of insurance and reform that the Obama administration has to take up, you know, we're not factoring very heavily, and we've gotten the rule defining, you know, these issues that are going to be crucial in terms of ending discrimination against mental illness, you know, that's this rule has taken us 5 years since passage of the bill. Now, I understand with health care reform, you know, there's adjustments and so forth to be made, but, you know, the whole strategy, I think, we'll know better when we get this final rule and know what we have to deal with. But my hope with the forum is that we unite the community. Now, you know, when President Kennedy spoke about this, he talked about people with intellectual disabilities along with people, those with mental illness. And, you know, and since then we've added people with substance use disorders. So, the bottom line is we all have become so siloed. So you've got the substance use disorder community, the severe mental illness community, the IDD community, and you know what? We're all talking about the same issues because it's a matter of the brain and these mechanisms all overlap in many respects in terms of the neuroscience. And also with everything overlaps in terms of the services we all need. But in terms of the politics, it hasn't overlapped. So when you go up to the Hill on a mental health agenda, you don't have the support of the collective community because we're not organized effectively, even though we have the same basic interests. And so that's my hope, is that we can articulate it in that way and say that those interests are actually the same interests as our returning American heroes. So this makes sense because it's every family in America, if you define it that way, and it's our returning heroes. And hopefully we can make this kind of politics of mental health the kind of celebrated and embraced politics, as opposed to the marginalized kind of politics that we've had. So that's just the hope that I have behind, you know, trying to use my uncle's historic vision and trying to remember it with the idea that we're now in the midst of a major transition in our healthcare system, such that we might be able to ultimately realize all the kinds of services that we deserve as a result of what everyone else gets. We want nothing more than what everyone else in healthcare gets, and that's what we need to define, and this is our time to do it.
Thinking, what could we put on the NEA-BPT website to support this and complement this effort?
Jim, Trish Bulbert here. I'm with NEA-BPD. I have a fairly simplistic question, but it seems to me that one thing that is, you know, crucial to this discussion is what, you know, ordinary people can do. So, for example, do you have a package of information or material that interested people could, you know, get out to other people, or is there a way in which people could help produce such materials? I mean, I think education gives people, or we need to educate people so they know what channels they can go through. Yes. It often seems to me pretty crazy in life that, I have nothing against it, but that, for example, Madonna, you know, if she has a concert, 50,000 tickets are sold out in 3 hours. And yet things that are absolutely crucial to health and happiness, somehow we're very slow to work on. Like, do we do a Twitter? You know, how can we help people figure out what to do to advance your agenda?
Well, I appreciate that question. And, you know, my agenda is to try to figure out how to fill that void, because I'm asking the same question, you know, where is it? Now, I know NAMI has done a tremendous job of trying to fill this vacuum, but I think they acknowledge the same thing that you've just acknowledged, and that is that, you know, there is, we do not have the unified kind of agenda. And it really limits us from being able to be effective as a community. Like, just take, for example, I'm the author of the mental health bill, and, you know, there's nowhere for me to go. I go to NAMI, I get sort of some of their agenda items. I go to Mental Health America. I go to the different advocacy groups. And, of course, you know, in terms of research and what we need to do to change the way we're organized in terms of our research activities, the way FDA is organized to accelerate research for, you know, all of our issues. You know, I share your frustration. It is pretty shocking to me that we aren't as
well-prepared and we're not as user-friendly, if you will, in being able to, you know, articulate this common vision. And I think that it is striking that on something as important as what we're talking about, that there isn't an easy kind of user-friendly way to both report discrimination, to define it, to have a political agenda that's prioritized, that, you know, galvanizes the most political support within not only the mental health community but the broader community. I mean, these are pretty basic issues, and I share your frustration. What we're trying to come up with through this anniversary of President Kennedy's signing the Community Mental Health Services Act is, you know, how do we begin to, construct this agenda? And this agenda is already out there, but what I'm talking about is how do we connect the dots in the advocacy community so we can be much more kind of effective in our total impact as a community. And it will rest entirely upon individuals and family members who want to be active because they're the only ones who ever have changed anything. So all I can tell you is you will hear more. We're in the formative stages of trying to pull this together. My belief is that the parity rule and this whole process of implementation of parity will become the fulcrum for our efforts because parity is very clear in terms of defining equal coverage, and if we get the transparency requirements that we'd like from insurance companies, then it will be something that will be very specific that we can ask people, no matter what community you live in around the country, what your situation is, how are you in your area measuring up in terms of compliance? Is your health plan, is your situation living up to the compliance of the law that says that, you know, the brain is part of the body and that mental health has to be treated the same as the rest of health care? We have very clear kind of definitions for measuring that, but if we don't get the way insurance companies make these decisions kind of really transparently revealed, it'll be difficult for us to empower you as respective consumers and family members to be very effective in helping to show and highlight where there are still patterns of discrimination.
Well, you know, May is Mental Health Month, and with the help of people in Congress, you know, a resolution was passed making May Borderline Personality Disorder Month. I mean, is it something that we as an organization or group of people could do to, you know, help focus and get information out, say, you know, during the month of May? You need kind of time frames and timelines and, you know, particular focal points. And I guess the other thing is that, you know, the number of voices being heard at any one particular time is very important. You know, what if people could, advocacy groups or some advocacy groups could get together and really focus, say, in May, and, you know, your target is to get 10,000 people to send an email to some poor insurance commissioner to kind of make a voice to startle someone to get something going.
Well, you know, my vision is that, you know, we have the political pressure that can come to bear because no one will want to be seen as discriminating. Mm-hmm. You know, right? Nobody wants to be seen as discriminatory. And my feeling is if we can and join our efforts with that of the Iraq-Afghan war veterans. You know, honestly, there isn't a CEO in America who could tolerate having one of these behavioral health managers manage behavioral health in a more restrictive way than any other part of their health care plan and get away with it. Mm. No way.
because if I can show up with a couple of veterans, you know, we've won the war, because there isn't going to be a CEO, there's not going to be a board of any company in America that will want their company to get the reputation as not only discriminating against a healthcare issue that involves practically every American family, because everybody's got something, because we all have, you know, brain health, and it doesn't always work out like the rest of our bodies don't always work out. And if we can do that and have veterans and have that as part of our message, I believe we can work out all these other kind of advocacy issues.
Mm-hmm. I just know I did a conference with the National Guard in Massachusetts, and it was on veterans, and it was on the issues that face them. And I was, the one thing that really struck me is with the military. Well, how educated, how much they were aware of the problems, but two, how much they need public support, in their work.
You're right on. I think I've heard the people say, thank you for the service, and then it's kind of like, be gone. But I'm concerned with Congressman Kennedy with his youngsters that were 5 after 9. Dr. Duckworth, do you have anything to add right now?
There's a lot to cover here, I think. I've had many thoughts along the way, but because we're over time, perhaps, you know, we could do my separate call, and I can pursue some of the aspects of this call that I have some experience and expertise in.
That would be great. Congressman Kennedy, thank you so much. I don't want to get in trouble with your wife and yourself and your youngster here with fearing keeping you away too long, but we really appreciate your making this time, and I think you've given us good guidance of organizing into an army, not for the battle, but for the total victory, which is very helpful. For everybody else, Helen has a story that I don't know a lot of people know about, of getting from very expensive and ineffective treatment to evidence-based treatment and an innovative parent-funded effort. And as our kind of fade out here of this part, I'd like Helen to share that briefly, because I think it's a very inspiring one of both using evidence-based research and parent support and activism to really make a difference. And after that, we will stay on for those who would like to discuss the follow-through on Congressman Kennedy's charge to activism.
Well, I thank you all, and being patient, and certainly welcome Ken's feedback. And those of you who've got a lot more experience in specific ways that you can offer, I'm just trying to look at this from the big picture, and how we as get our political message so that we can address all these other issues. And I just am up against a power play, and insurance companies are going to never honor evidence-based or expert-based medicine, because they don't do so in mental health today. We can have everything on our side, and they'll still treat us in a discriminatory way. If we don't figure out the better political way to force them, either through their own self-interest or through greater kind of rulemaking and procedural ways to get, the kinds of things that I think you'll hear from Helen and others actually to be reimbursed by our healthcare system. So I appreciate everyone's patience, and thank you all so very much. And if I weren't in benefiting from mental health treatment, I wouldn't be able to have the pleasure of being able to hang up and have two beautiful children to tuck into bed, and a wife and a home life that would not have been possible without the benefit of the kind of mental health care that you're all fighting for. So I
I'm indebted to all of you for your continued advocacy, and I look forward to working with you to achieve common victory.
And those are personal and societal benefits that it's hard to put money on. It's almost incalculable.
Incalculable. Thanks again, Jim.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
I'm going to ring off as well. Thanks all. And I'm happy to follow up with some of these thoughts in a future call.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll be back in touch quickly with it.
Thanks, Ken.
Good night.
Helen, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Would you be so gracious as to share your story for those who are on? Because I think it's a very inspiring thing to know the potential of what can be achieved.
Yes, I'd be happy to, and I would like to start by saying that all politics is local, and we're now going very local with this. First of all, I would like to thank everyone who's on this call for the superhuman effort that you're making on behalf of people like me. My diagnoses are borderline personality disorder, bipolar, PTSD, and anorexia bulimia, with comorbidity from which doctors told me I was hopelessly sick and would never work again. And after 54 medications and $1 million in treatment, I have recovered and lead an imperfect but fully engaged life with a wealth of friends and family, an active social life, and meaningful work. In fact, a play I've written is going to be produced off-Broadway in the fall. But I still feel as if I lead a double life, for I only know one other person who's recovered from such severe psychiatric illnesses. I never believed that my own story had any value until I told it before an audience. And it was then I realized that I could pull beauty from the darkness. And since then, I've spoken to other groups and have learned firsthand that my voice can provide hope and reduce stigma. And I would like the chance to contribute more, much more. One of the crucial causes of my recovery was not $1 million. In fact, it cost me nothing. It was the Connections Place in New York City, a work program created specifically for borderlines, under the auspices of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. I attended twice a week for 3 straight years, first as a client and later as a volunteer. The curriculum was brilliantly designed and executed by a researcher and a clinician. It included DBT and vocational models for a return to the workplace or school. The groups were small, with men and women from the ages of 18 to 54. Guided by excellent leaders, each group member helped mentor the others. In individual and group sessions, we learned how to overcome the physical and emotional obstacles that had kept us paralyzed. I wish you could have seen the striving and determination that led to so many triumphs. Sadly, the program, which should have been duplicated across the country, was suspended after 3 years due to lack of funding.
Thank you. Our challenge, advocacy to get support behind these things to make the transformations possible for many folks.
Yes.
This is kind of an informal poll as to how would folks like to stay on to discuss follow-through or reactions to Congressman Kennedy's talk or any other related subject?
Jim, this is just Trish. I think so. Sorry, go ahead.
What is that?
Somebody needs to mute their phone. Hello?
Is anyone still on?
Yep.
I'm still here.
Yes.
A lot of people, I tried to unmute everybody, but there was background noise, so I muted everybody except the ones who had called in on a different line. So I'm happy to unmute everybody if people would keep themselves on mute with that background noise. Shall I try that again?
Try it again. Thank you. Hello, folks. Anybody, if you would like to contribute to the discussion, it's unmuted. You can do so. If you're not seeking to speak, please keep your phone muted. It's open forum time.
This is Ash. I do have a question for people. What do people think about the fact that the DSM has moved away from the multi-axial system? Do you think that would allow for more effective, like, unified voices for reform?
I missed part of your thing. If it moved away from what?
The fact that the DSM has moved away from the multi-axial system.
Okay.
Do you think that allows us for, like, better fighting for reform as a unified mental health issue rather than multiple little battles of diagnoses?
I think we're going to wind up with a very different RDoC, the research domain of criteria, effort to have variables and psychophysiologically and by imaging that have a strong genetic, the behavioral genetic. You already see that you wind up with two, three, four strong underlying things, forces for genetic factors for a array of disorders, which then can go in a variety of ways. And that's true for borderline, by the way. Borderline and depression, according to Kindler's behavior genetics work, share a very strong genetic loading and also a very strong environmental loading, which kind of makes sense that they're both concerned with emotional dysfunction, depression kind of low and flat and borderline fluctuating. He hasn't done it with bipolar and other things, but I would suspect that we would find some relationships there. With and then there's a within the personality disorders, six of the disorders share a very strong general loading that's like neuroticism. And borderline and antisocial behavior share a very strong loading. And then there's the small, unique. So the disorders are just not very, and in that sense, very functional if you're going to be testing things. So more than the multi-axis, it's getting to these underlying characteristics and from a different, somewhat different path. Leanna Clark, who was on the DSM-5, is advocating looking for personality traits that underline. So if you, and to differentiate, rather than using symptoms, you can have hundreds of different combinations of symptoms for borderline right now. You would look at the personality traits, which generally have high genetic loadings, and target those for change. And I think that those sort of efforts will be more helpful. It's sort of like looking at the eye. And if you say, I'm having trouble seeing, then if you had a one treatment solves for everything, which is kind of how we are in psychiatry and psychology now, versus it's a matter that you need a corrective lens, you have a cataract, that you have retinal deterioration, there's a score of other things. Differentiate it even within some of those, like glaucoma is not a single thing, it's a number of different variations. So the disc that typically circular disc around the retina that go with glaucoma are a frequent correlate, but are not neither necessary nor sufficient for a diagnosis of glaucoma. And so it goes. So you really have to have effective treatment differentiation. And in cancer, that's beginning to be the case. 10 different cancers, not by sight so much, but by genetics.
I think the Tricia here. I think the point was really that, you know, changing global kind of. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt someone.
Go ahead, Trish.
Are you there, Trish?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think what Kennedy was talking about tonight really was, you know, changing the whole global perceptions or appreciations. And then, you know, for example, if you do have something wrong with your eye and you go to an eye doctor, the expectation is that the eye doctor will track down and determine what the cause is and then the treatment, even if he has to send you to other specialists to kind of figure it out. I think where I got a little confused, and maybe if it were possible to have, you know, the kind of a call in with Dr. Douglas, a bit of his background might be helpful. But I know I fumbled a bit when I was kind of talking. I found it hard to figure out. On one hand, there's talk of, you know, really the insurance companies and transparency and the political will or move, you know, to work on that. On the other hand, how individuals or advocacy groups can help build up the kind of climate to give, you know, the heft, if you like, to the political movement. I kind of didn't get much of a feel that was, you know, specific or what we need to do.
I sort of had the feeling that we're waiting for a grand plan, and in the meantime, there's a war going on, the battle going on, and we have to move forward with the battle. Even though we can't just execute the grand plan first, in my opinion. Mm. You know, that there has to be a coordinated but an individual effort to change that perspective, to challenge the status quo, to push for parity.
Or to push for the implementation of it, and I'm not very clear how that's supposed to come about. I mean, do you, you know, do the 1 million march on Washington? Do you get organized by state? I don't know. You know, I guess in the current terminology, where's the call to action in this?
Right. I wonder what other organizations are out there that organizations like NEA BPD could partner with in order to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Or whether at the political level people see that would be an effective use of time. I don't know. I think that's where our discussion is going to take us. I mean, whether there is some kind of big global change or not, I think even within that, for example, for borderline, we will have to keep on doing what we're doing, because I think, as people have pointed out, you know, it is so heavily stigmatized that the chances are. And since it's just being included in, like, NAMI umbrella, you know, the chances are that it would still not, you know, be the first thing that people dealt with or thought about. I don't know, Jim. I think my brain is a little tired after kind of focusing, trying to focus on that. Do you think we can plan to follow up on Dr. Duckworth and have another session?
It sounds good. I will follow up with Dr. Ken Duckworth. I think he'll have a very interesting perspective from looking at all the Blue Cross Blue Shield claims.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly when we talk about partnering, we already have established a long-term partnership with unequal that it might be with NAMI.
Thank you. Any other thoughts?
I just want to say some people have emailed in saying that they were very touched by Helen's story and would like to have contact with her. So, Helen, if that's okay with you, how can they best reach you?
Excuse me. let me think about that. I guess by email would probably be the best.
Okay. Do you want me to send you, how about if people just send me an email and I can forward it to you and then you can choose to?
If you don't mind, that would be terrific.
Okay, so that's NEADD@AOL.com and I'll forward any emails on to Helen. But if they're Twittering about Helen.
Is Helen the woman who spoke at the beginning about her story of recovery and it possibly going to Broadway?
Yes, yes.
Wonderful. This is Debbie Corso asking, and I'd love to speak with Helen as well, so great.
Oh, good. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Hi, Perry.
Wonderful.
Debbie, what was your take on the talk this evening?
You know, I think it's an interesting perspective that Congressman Kennedy has, and I'm really in awe of just the passion and enthusiasm and commitment he has to this whole cause and his ideas around having us band together in unison regardless of our diagnosis to come together collectively because there is power in numbers. Mm-hmm. And also, I do like his approach with regards to using the very important need of our returning soldiers' mental health needs, the invisible wounds that he referred to, as a way to really get things jump-started in terms of getting people to understand how important it is that treatment is available equally for people who have mental health issues just as much as physical health issues. And I also strongly agreed with his comment on how when he himself was not receiving proper mental health care treatment, he was running up all kinds of bills in the medical arena, you know, in terms of, I can relate to that, going to the emergency room and having all of these things manifest somatically because they weren't being addressed with the most important part of the body, which is the brain, or one of the most important parts. And I really enjoyed the call, and thank you so much for inviting me to be here today and listen in.